Computer, initialize holosuite.
And welcome to another episode of The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Perry.
I'm your host, David. Today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 19, Ties of Blood and Water. Before we continue, you can find us on Facebook, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube as The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast.
Absolutely, and tonight, as we talk about a really special episode featuring Kira Nerys, I think we're going to get into some pretty interesting topics of how they kind of, you know, cross over and gray some lines here for us in regards to her character and also the Cardassians. But, as always, I say you should follow us because we're great, we're awesome, we're a good time. We're going to break down this stuff for you and hopefully present it to you in a new way that maybe you haven't thought about before. But before we do any of that, as always, I'd like to check in. So, David, how has your week been?
Week's been good. A lot of great sci-fi this week, obviously.
I was going to say, I kind of know how your week's been, you know.
We'll start with last night. You and I went and saw Dune Part 2 with some friends, so 2 hours and 45 minutes of Dune.
Bit long, as we were saying. Yes. Bit long.
Yeah. Yeah. Great, though. You know, I brought the book with me to work and was reading some parts from the second half of the book, because it's, of course, the second half of the book that the movie Part 2 is based on. And, you know, I'm filled with like, they change certain things. Some things I don't like, they change. Some things work really well. Some things, I mean, visually, it's stunning. The music is amazing. Yes. Don't get me wrong, it's still a great movie. But the purist in me is like, oh, but that's not the same. What's going on? Like, that, they didn't do that. They didn't do that.
I have to admit, I was in that camp too. Like, again, I totally agree. I think that the visuals on the movie were fantastic. I think that the music was fantastic. As we said last night, there are certain parts where I felt like I was trying to, like, they were trying to rattle me out of my seat. A few times. But, you know, now it's been a little bit since I've read the book, but I pride myself on having a pretty good memory. And there are certainly some things that were changed and I had me kind of being like, wait a second, I know that that's not quite right. Or there was some of this has definitely been, you know, changed. And I understand that this is going to happen when you're dealing with a source material like a book, especially because of the fact that, you know, there's decades between when it was written and then released and all this other stuff. So times change, our cultural shifts, we're going to have these things that happen that are going to make certain things written, even in sci-fi, seem dated after a certain amount of time. So I get that there's a need to kind of update the look a bit, or the feel, I guess. Yeah, there are certain parts where I'm just like, I wish if you're gonna base it off of such detailed source material, you should probably try to keep it as close to that source material as you can. Partly because there is a lesson to be learned in something being so dated anyway. There's, you know, being able to point out those stark changes and how we have grown over time is a lesson in of its own self that we miss out on when they make these rushes to update and contemporize certain things. So, but still a great movie. I thought that the cast overall did a really great job. I 100%. Loved the performances. I thought everybody was just fantastic.
Yeah.
Did you feel like there's anybody, like, I don't want to spend our whole time, because we could definitely spend a lot of time breaking this movie down, but like, did you
I could spend this whole episode talking about Dune, man. Like,
tempted earlier when you texted me earlier. I was like, man, we just take off work right now, because
I'll tell you right now, I stopped myself from texting you at one point, because like, I could text, but
David,
you know,
I turned my phone off. I'm not kidding, because I was so into it, and I was like, you were texting me, and I was like, and then it was this, and then I was like, no, you work, and I turned. Yep, I had to turn it off because I was like,
I basically did the same thing. Yeah. Yep, yep.
So that's why I didn't respond to you after that last one. I was like, no, here it comes.
Yeah. I'll just start by saying that I think it's Austin Butler who plays Fade Rautha was the standout from this movie because he wasn't in the first one.
No.
So every time he's on screen, he's stealing the scenes. He is fantastic. Standout performance, I think, from everybody because again, he wasn't in the first one, and so he's the like the of the new cast, the one that really stands out. I mean, even Christopher Walken's kind of only in it briefly.
Briefly,
Fade Rautha. He's there, man.
Interesting that you bring him up, Austin Butler, because we ended up seeing a preview for another movie that he's going to be in, The Bike Riders. He's in that movie as well. He looked so different that I didn't realize that that was him. And I mean, I went, you know, obviously went home, did my little deep dive there. And when I searched him, because he was one of the first people I Googled when I got back, and I saw that, I was like, oh, so, you know, that's, he's in this next movie here.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, between him, Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, and is her name Juliana Pugh? Is that right?
Florence Pugh. Florence.
I don't know where I got Juliana from. But so all of them are on this like list of like considered like the next gen, next wave of major Hollywood elites. They're like the top. They're all in the top, you know, four, top 10, whatever. So, because it's like best stars under 30 or something like that. And I think they're all in the list there. So, yeah, I think they do a great job. He was also in the Elvis movie as well.
Yes.
So,
which I haven't seen, but
that's I have not
somebody
seen...
came on my radar.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's I also seen in the show. He's in the show Masters of the Air, which I've been watching, that one based on the book that I also read about the bombers in World War II. He's playing one of the main characters. But yeah, he's definitely a rising star, man. Keep an eye out for Austin Butler. I think he's going to be, like you said, he's going to be one of those people who like, oh, he's in that, he's in that, he's in that. And yeah.
And I would say the same is true of all of them. I mean, Zendaya's already had a pretty stellar career with the Spider-Man movies, of course. And then she has her show Euphoria, which is on Max. Florence Pugh was in Oppenheimer, and she was in Black Widow. Mm-hmm. You know, again, already kind of just one of those people that's been coming up as a bit of a powerhouse, as is Timothée Chalamet as well, between this movie, the Willy Wonka movies, and...
Yep.
I'm trying to think of some other things that he was in. I know he did several, I guess we would consider them foreign films, before coming over to America too. Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
So, I'm just, again, I was thoroughly impressed with everybody. Yeah. And not to say that just the young crowd was doing their thing either. You know, Josh Brolin, Javier Bardem. Excellent performances. Excellent performances here. Josh Brolin's just been on a roll consistently. probably these past, like, I'm going to say probably the past 10 years, maybe a little bit longer, depending on where you want to, you know, look at things. But, I mean, he was a child star as well, and now he's up and doing his own thing here. Great, great stuff. And, you know, the movie, it bears out. Opening week, you know, the movie dropped March 1st, did $170 million in its opening weekend here, whatever. Right. And we were part of that. So, yeah, I mean, great, great movie. If you haven't seen it, go see it. Again, bit long. And personal word of advice, don't sit in seats that have side buttons on them that allow them to, like, adjust or whatever. I battled mine like all night, the whole time. So, really kind of took me out of the movie.
It was funny. I was sitting next to you, and every now and then you'd go, "Dag damn it, stupid."
Yeah. I'd just be sitting, minding my own business, and all of a sudden it'd be like,
like, ah! You know? What am I at? The dentist? Come on.
Right. Yeah. Just, it was so annoying. So annoying. So.
Yeah. And I'll just follow all that up with, as much as I enjoyed the movie, I really enjoy the book. And I even just perusing it again today, I was like, man, there's so much subtlety in the book they just couldn't bring to the screen. And that's why they had to make certain changes just to make the, you know, plot work on screen. Yeah. And a lot of times I was just like, ah, oh, man, I wish they had just tried harder to stick with what's on the in the book. But, I mean, at times I'm like, okay, I mean, for example, Chani in the book is a little bit more 2D. She's not quite as nuanced as the character that's played by Zendaya. She's more of a three-dimensional back and forth. She's got conflict with, like, you know, Paul. In the book, she, like, pretty much is into him from the get-go. They both realize, you know, they have spice visions of each other, and so they're immediately like, oh, we're meant for each other, boom. That's kind of it.
That is the part that I didn't appreciate them cutting, is the fact that, you know, as much as we were seeing Paul having visions of her, right, she was also having visions of him in the book.
Exactly.
And I thought that was something that's critical to the development of their relationship that we don't get to see and we really should have.
Right.
Because she, and if I remember correctly from the book, she does have dreams of him, but she always just wrote them off as just dreams. She didn't think anything of it until he shows up. And then she's like, yeah, you're the one, you're the guy that I've, because that was her thing. It was, she was saying he was the one, not because she believed him as the Messiah, the prophet, but more, you're the one, because you're the one from my dreams.
Yes.
And then it turns into more as they move through and do other stuff.
Right.
So yeah, I did miss that. I did wish that they had done, you know, more to show them, you know, connected that way. But yeah, so I agree with you on that.
And I'll just summarize it by saying that the movies, both of them, are not the movie I would have made, in the sense that if I were in charge, I would have done things differently. But that's okay, in the sense that, well, it's not my movie, so I'm trying to enjoy someone else's movie, and I can't enjoy it. Yes, half the time my brain is like, that's not how it happened in the book, but didn't stop me from enjoying it. So,
well, I think that we're just going to be those people who have those issues because we did read the books, and, you know, for us too, because there weren't movies for so long, we reread the books, you know, and then what movies there were. There was the movie that came out in the 80s. Then, you know, the Sci-Fi Channel did one in 2000. You know, so these were definitely, you know, I don't want to just say lower budget. They were different budgets, reflective of a different time. And so the way of telling the story was vastly different than what they could do
100%
now, you know. So, and so then, and there's going to be people who have never read the books and who won't read the books, and they'll just watch these movies. And I'm kind of jealous because they're getting great quality here. Not exactly what we had with the other stuff before. And yeah, great stuff.
Right. The other thing that I did this week was I read book 3 of the Red Rising series, Morning Star. I'm telling you, Per, I said it last week, I'll say it again this week. This might be the best book series I've read so far, like, ever. And I don't mean that in, like, Dune and Expanse, like, they're done. I'm talking about, like, the plotting in these books is so exciting and so page-turning and so enjoyable that I was just, like, floored when plot elements would happen. Like, at the climax of that book, I didn't see it coming because I was already, like, page, and, like, I didn't have time to try and predict what was happening. And so there was moments where I was like, I can't believe this is happening. And then if I gave myself a moment to, like, pause, I'd be like, no, wait a minute. No, this makes sense. And it's great. I can't wait. I've heard that there are rumors they're going to try and make that into, like, a movie or a TV show. I hope it happens. Really enjoyed those books. There are more that I haven't read yet, but I'm going to take a break and read some other things. But yeah, really enjoyed that book. That's, again, book 3 of the Red Rising series. And then I did start Avatar, the original cartoon series, because I know there's now a live action on Netflix. So I was like, I don't know if I'll watch the live action, but I always hear people rave about the TV show. So I started it, and it's definitely meant for kids. I'm only like 6 episodes in. You know, season 1 has 20 episodes or something. They're only like 3 seasons from what I can tell.
Yeah.
But it does give me certain vibes of Samurai Jack, in a sense of like – the shorter episodes, the episodes don't always tie together real neatly, but there's like an overarching plot. I mean, Samurai Jack has a very different animation style.
Yeah.
And everything, I mean, it's very different, but I'm just saying that I get kind of that sense. Maybe I should put it this way. It's from the same era of television, And so you can sense that.
It's from the same era, but definitely the audiences for both of those shows were vastly different. Samurai yes. Jack was always geared towards older people. Not necessarily yes. just, you know, you need to be, you know, in your 20s or whatever, adult, but definitely more of an older like vibe teens. To that show versus, right, yeah. versus Avatar was aimed more at children, but during that young adult phase, transitioning yeah. into teenage 10 to 12 years. And, versus yeah, like you
13
know,
to 14. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a different bent to both of those shows. And then, you know, Samurai Jack, especially when you get into the final season of that show, it's definitely, that is strictly for adults. Don't watch oh, that yeah. show if you're not, I'm going to say, if you're not 25.
Well,
go watch it.
And of course, one of the reasons the two shows are tied together is because the actor who played Aku also plays one of the characters in
He is Uncle Iroh.
That's it. Yeah. And yes. Man,
that voice. Yes.
Yeah.
I it's mean, amazing you how such a gravelly voice can be so meaningful.
Yes.
And impactful across certain things.
You get glimpses of the Aku like style every now and then, but man, nothing beats the Aku voice, man. No. I mean, voice was just perfect for that character. I forget the voice actor's name, of course, but yeah.
Mako. Ugh. It's Mako. He's Mako. Dead. He yeah. died. Unfortunately, he died shortly before the end of
Avatar.
So yeah, sorry. Mild spoiler. Yeah. Yes. Now, I did watch Avatar when it originally aired years ago. Okay. I found it completely by mistake. I was still in Kentucky at the time, and I don't even remember exactly what it was I was doing, but I had a little bit of downtime, and turned the TV on, and it was on. And I had already missed several episodes, and you said you're 6 episodes in. Have you met King Bumi yet?
Yeah, that was the okay. episode I just finished tonight.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's
and I realized it was his friend Bumi early on. I was yeah. like, I know who that is.
Yeah. Well, that's the first episode that I watched, and I found it hilarious. And yeah. that's what got me wanting to watch the rest of the show, because right. I thought that episode was wildly funny. Coming from something that I knew nothing about it was totally unexpected. I was cracking up laughing at Bumi. And so right. I was like, okay, I'm going to watch this. And I loved the show. So yeah. I have not seen the live action yet. I'm kind of hesitant to do so because the last live action.
I have heard some negative things. Yeah. So that's why I was like, I don't know if I'll do it or not. But I figured, hey, why not? I need something to watch, or at least something yeah. different. So.
Well, the last live action Avatar was with M. Night Shyamalan, and it was horrendous. I saw it in the theater, and I left demanding my money back. It was terrible. It was absolutely terrible.
Did you get it? Did you get your money back?
No, I did not get my money back. Of course not. But I was, and I mean, I yeah. did the whole paid for the 3D, all Ooh. Of it, and it was awful. It was yeah. awful. So,
M. Night Shyamalan, man, he had a peak at one point, but he's ever since. Yeah. He's yeah. Oh so, well.
So speaking of things that have bad reviews, I'm going to go the other way because there's something I wanted to talk about because I noticed that it's finally happened and I wanted to bring this up before we dive into our episode. I know, guys, we're almost 20 minutes in and haven't gotten there yet. Bear with me, all right? I feel like this is important. Star Trek Discovery. I'm gonna do it again. So as we know, the final season is getting ready to air here in April, and I am really excited about seeing this next season, but I am a bit sad about seeing it go. I definitely feel like the show not only had a lot of potential, but it lived up to its potential in a lot of ways, and some of the things that people were complaining about were not necessarily the fault of the show or the showrunners. It was more because of the fact that we had much smaller seasons. Whether you want to believe it or not, we have been conditioned with Trek to watch the show that has 20 plus episodes in a season. To suddenly go to a show that has even, you know, less than half of that a lot of the time, that was a hard adjustment for a lot of people to make. And so when you're having to watch these characters make emotional leaps that we were having to watch with Discovery, it did have a ring of insincerity about it, but only because we didn't get to watch them kind of mull over some of these things over several episodes. We didn't get to watch the full growth of the character. One week they were one way, and the next week they had already had this, you know, kind of, you know, epiphany moment, and we didn't get to see kind of the gentle evolution of that like we were used to. Since Next Generation, every Star Trek show has been plagued with naysayers and people trying to shout it down and, oh, it's not Trek, this is terrible, it's going to fail, so forth and so on. But really, for the first time ever, we've had the ability to be online and be a part of a community that gives you rapid either validation or downvoting you to oblivion or whatever it is. And really, I think that's what bolstered so many people to come out so strongly and consistently negative for this show. And I just want to say to everyone who was a part of that, shame on you. To be completely honest, absolutely shame on you. The show is 100% Trek. If you don't think so, then stop watching all Trek, okay? You're completely missing the whole point of Star Trek. You all want to think that you're the Federation, you're Starfleet officers, but really you're a bunch of Cardassians. You're a bunch of Romulans. You're Ferengi. You're awful, all right? And wow. I'm absolutely upset because I'm seeing the thing that I said I was going to see, which is now that they've announced that it's ending, slowly but surely all these articles are coming out, new things are coming out, new posts, new threads, whatever, of people being like, okay, Discovery wasn't that bad, or, oh, I don't like Discovery, but this thing they did was really cool, or, oh, you know what? I'm recognizing that this is actually more advanced or more ahead than I thought it was and they slip it in there. Now on my third rewatch of Discovery, now on my fourth rewatch, if you hated the show, why are you rewatching it for a third or a fourth time? I can kind of see a second time because, if you didn't like it, you go back to give it a second chance, whatever. But clearly something about the show resonated with you and you're watching it yet again and one more time after that for good measure. And now you're coming away with, oh, well, this was good or this was cool or I liked it when this character did that. Whatever. I said that was going to happen. And now that I'm seeing it, it just, even though I knew that it was coming, it upsets me because the show is ending because there was such a huge backlash. And I'm not going to say just solely because I'm not going to give you anybody that much credit. But there was such a negative, look on this show for so long. And then the wellspring of support, the resurgence of support for Strange New Worlds and Prodigy, even the cartoon show, has really kind of, pushed Discovery into this kind of redheaded stepchild category. And it's the show that had to come first. Discovery, crawled so the rest of these shows could run and fly. And without Discovery, we would not have Strange New Worlds. I'm telling you, without Discovery, we would not have Strange New Worlds. We would not have Lower Decks. We would not have Prodigy. And those shows are going to end too. And we're going to end up in this weird void again where there will be no Trek for like 10 years. And then, unfortunately for me, I'll be in my like 50s or 60s and there'll be another show. And I'll be quite upset because we had and have a great show in Discovery. And we really should have backed that show much stronger than we did. We should have been voicing our support of it. We're not going to get a legacy show. That whole thing with Seven of Nine and all of them, as much as I would really love to see it, it's not going to happen. Terry Metalis has said that they would love it, but it's more like a fancy idea. It's just not going to happen. We had a great product in Discovery. We had solid characters. We had solid leads. We had solid directors. Yes, they were a little bit, experimental on things, but they had to be. And now it's over, and I just don't want to see any more people being like, now that I think about it. No, you had your shot. You had your chance. I know who you are, and I'm not going to let you get away with now being an apologist or covering up for the fact that you were so against the show now that it's over. For those of you who were Discovery fans, thank you. And I hope that, you're not as too sad or too bitter about the show ending. You should know that a lot of the actors are out right now doing like interviews and things like that about the show, and in particular about the upcoming season. Also about the impact of the show on Trek overall. Some of them are really great. Captain Michael Burnham herself, Sonequa Martin-Green, sat down with Tawny Newsome, who plays Beckett Mariner on Lower Decks, and they do a respective, I think it's like an hour-long interview, which you can find right now on YouTube, and you can watch it, and it's really, it's great. It's insightful, it's funny at times. Watching them talk about the impact of their shows on themselves, on Trek, on the franchise, everything else. It's really interesting to hear from them. And it's just them. There's no other third person like interviewing them or anything like that. It's just them talking. Go watch it. I think that you'll enjoy that as well. And hopefully it gives you a little bit more appreciation for Discovery as well. And I hope that they come back. They're already slated to do Starbase 31 movie. I hope they do something with the Discovery cast and not just waste them the way they've wasted other crews, looking at you, Deep Space Nine, in the past, and they really give these guys another shot at something. Don't give me another show that jumps forward so far in the future that these guys are basically dead and there's no way of them coming back. I don't want that. Give me some more of these characters. They deserve it. They're wonderfully made-up characters. I would love to see more of that in some iteration, and I'm just going to continue to say, I'm sad that it's gone. And, yeah, you people who shouted it down, you will get no sympathy from me. So I'll be waiting for you when the time comes and those debates starts. So be aware.
Right, yeah.
But we're not here to talk about all that.
We are. 26 minutes in. What are we talking about?
So many things. Yeah. But sorry. Let's get back on track here with the real deal. Ties of Blood and Water. A nice Kira-centric episode that we have. Would you like to give the recap or would you want me to do it?
You go for it. It's been a couple days since I watched it, and I usually am better at recapping if I just watch it, so go ahead. Yeah.
And just for the sake of time, I will try to be brief here, because obviously we're going to go into this, and then, So, this episode is, it starts with Dax and Kira, they're waiting, Dax, Kira, and Worf, waiting on an airlock, and as they're waiting for various people to come off of the shuttle, and the person that arrives for Kira is a former legate to Kenny Gamore, which, if you can remember, he is from the episode, I forget the name of the episode, Second Skin, that's what it was, and that's the one where Kira had been kidnapped and surgically altered to appear to be Cardassian, and they implant her into to Kenny's house, saying that she was his missing daughter, Ileana. And basically, it was all a plot by the Obsidian Order to expose him as a member of the Cardassian dissident movement, and basically oust him from power, because as a legate in the Cardassian military, he had a lot of power and a lot of influence, and they didn't want him using that, obviously, to spark this uprising. Right. That plan did not work. At least not fully. T'Keni was able to escape, and he was basically living in exile. So this is the first time that we see him again since that, and Kira is all excited, because in the interim time since we last saw T'Keni, obviously Cardassia has gone through a lot of different changes. The government has risen and fallen a couple of times. The Klingons have attacked, and now the Dominion has set up camp on Cardassia, and this new partnership has put the military firmly in control under the astute leadership of Gul Dukat. But now T'Keni is here, and Kira is excited about having him here because she believes he is Cardassia's best hope for putting up a resistance and for him to lead the government in absentia, because he's in exile. So she's got this whole plan worked out to feed intelligence reports and propaganda, anti-propaganda stuff about the Dominion via him to Cardassia. And she's just wheeling and dealing her plan, not really paying attention to the fact that this man is moving slow. He doesn't seem to be very interested in any of that. Until finally they get to her quarters, and he tells her so. He's like, that all sounds great. I wish I could do it, but I can't because I'm dying. He's got a incurable fatal disease, and he has, days, maybe weeks to live. They go to the infirmary. Bashir checks him out, confirms the diagnosis, and is basically like, all we can really do for you is keep you comfortable. There's some experimental things, but that's pretty much it. Next, we see Kira with Captain Sisko, where she's kind of debriefing him on the situation. And Sisko's like, hey, you know, basically sucks that he's dying, but this guy has a lot of knowledge here that we could really use. Maybe you can just, you know, use this time to get that intel while he, you know, slips away here. Mm-hmm. She kind of hesitantly agrees, and then shortly thereafter, they're interrupted by, Sisko gets a call from Dukat, who, after they trade their little BS barbs, Dukat's basically like, hey, we know T'Keni's there, we want him back. Sisko's like, yeah, don't hold your breath, and hangs up on him, and that's basically that. Kira spends the next few days with T'Keni. She pretty much, they get into this father-daughter role heavily here. Right. And she does start to take a few notes as he's telling her about different things that they've done or that he's done, that Cardassia is responsible for, spy stuff, political stuff. He's giving her all of these bits and pieces of information, and she's just, you know, writing it down while he's getting sicker and sicker. Finally, a Jem'Hadar battlecruiser shows up, and it's got Gul Dukat and Wayoon, the Vorta, who's like the handler for the Dominion, on board. They come onto the station. Once again, they want T'Keni to come back to Bajor, and they're like, hey, you know, he's an honored whatever. And Sisko's like, yeah, okay, not really buying right. the BS. Basically telling them, yeah, you know, yeah, I don't know, go hug a warp core. We're not gonna do it. And yeah. I like that. Go hug a warp core. I'm gonna do that. So you know, they were kind of on the fence about keeping them on the station. Meanwhile, Kira's getting all this intel. At one point, someone tries to slip a bottle of Kanar to Kenny to poison him, to kill him faster, because apparently him dying of whatever just isn't enough. Sisko, of course, finds out about it, thwarts that plan. We find out that the Vorta are basically immune to every kind of poison, because Wayoon drinks the poisoned Kanar. And then Kira and Dukat have a moment, and Dukat is basically telling her, T'Keni's not the guy you think he is. And he intimates that he was responsible for a massacre at a particular monastery. And this was a you know, major plot point for Kira, because apparently she had attempted to it was because of what happened at that monastery that she had been missing from her own father's bedside when he was dying. So that's kind of the other story that we're working with here, is Kira is having to reconcile the fact that she is in this father-daughter relationship with this dying man. When her own father was dying, she almost seemed to not be able to be bothered with the fact that he was dying. In fact, when he was attacked by the Cardassians and shot, he begged her to stay by his bedside, and she didn't. She ran off to pull another strike mission, and by the time she got back, he had died. And he had died calling her name, which, you know, obviously still upsets her to this day. Kira then, you know, she does a little bit of investigating, finds out about T'Keni, and then she angrily confronts him later on about what was going on. T'Keni admits that, yes, he was a part of the massacre. He had his, you know, had a hand in it, but he was, you know, a junior officer, so he was only doing what he was ordered to do. It wasn't like he just, you know, passed a decree or anything like that. But that's not enough for Kira, and she storms off, and she stays away from T'Keni for a couple of days. Now, keep in mind, the guy's dying, so now he's potentially going to die alone because Kira can't reconcile the feelings. She gets talking to from Dukat, not Dukat, I'm sorry, gets talking Bashir. To from Bashir, who's basically like, no one deserves to die alone, which again triggers the memory of her own father, who did, in fact, die alone. And so she goes back to T'Keni. They eventually make up just before he dies, and Ducat then makes another play for Takeni's remains, but Sisko's like, yeah, no, his funeral arrangements are already being handled, and we see that Kira has buried him beside her father. So it's a beautiful scene, where, or very scenic, where she's picked to bury this guy. But that's essentially the episode. Obviously, we're going to break down some things here for you, but that's essentially it for this episode. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, for sure. You've hit pretty much all the highlights. We'll get into the finer details here.
So, as always, David, first-time viewer, I'd love to ask, what did you think of this episode?
I'm going to have to say I didn't really care for this episode all that much. It sounds like you liked it, but I'll say just that I just wasn't a fan. I just found it to be a little too sentimental. I feel like Kira's character is supposed to have kind of grown a little bit past some of this stuff. The whole having a temper tantrum about him having had a part in the massacre, it just seems a bit, it just felt kind of forced. Like, she's been an officer, you know, the first officer on Deep Space Nine for 5 years now. She's been dealing with a lot of these issues. She knows this guy. When he came on the station, she was all lovey-dovey, and they were, oh, you're like my daughter, you're like my daughter, you're like my daughter, you're like my daughter, you're like my daughter. I'm like, okay, I get it. It's like,
yeah, these two are... He does say it a lot. I will give you that. He was quite heavy-handed with the, you're like a daughter to me, you're like my daughter, I'm like a grandfather because of you. Yeah.
It just felt like a lot. So what they chose to do with this episode is, instead of focusing on the major A plot of Deep Space Nine, the Dominion is in the Alpha Quadrant now, they're allied with the Cardassians, we have a problem with them, how are we going to get the Cardassian resistance movement going, which is what the plot starts with, it instead turns into Kira caring for a dying man who is a member of the race that enslaved her people, and that triggering her traumatic memories of her own father dying. And I just feel like this episode, if we could, you know, switch things around, would be better off in, like, seasons 1 through 3, not season 5. I feel like at this point, we've had some of these Kira-style episodes of her dealing with the trauma of the occupation. She's been, you know, moving forward with that. And then her going and, like, when he says to her that I need to give you all my memories about, or all my intel about the Cardassian government so that someone has that information before I die. When she goes to Sisko and is all like, oh, I don't know if I'm the right person. Maybe I'm not going to ask the right questions. Like, I was like, are you kidding me? This character is a professional high up in this military organization, the Bajoran government. She has a relationship with this guy, and suddenly she's got cold feet. I was having trouble with this one.
Yeah. So I will tell you, the reason I like this episode is because it is so, I'm going to use the term bittersweet here.
Sure.
Because you do see a lot of this potential for a great story, but I feel like you get the great story because some of that is squandered if you really have to put yourself into the character here of Kira, who is having to reconcile some fairly complex emotions that she's kind of having to juggle here. You know, on the one hand, this is a man who she has, through experience with him, come to view him as a father figure. She's also having to reconcile the fact that for her own father, this is something that she could not do for him. She could not stay by his side. And she is, if nothing else, Kira is intensely loyal to Bajor and to Bajorans. And the fact that she had this very loving relationship with this particular former legate Cardassian, whereas her own father kind of suffered and struggled here when she had the time to do it for him, I could understand why you would say, oh, she's been this officer for 5 years, she's been this person, she should have reconciled some of these things beforehand. But it's like, really? When has she ever had the opportunity that we know of, that we've seen, to really kind of sit and get over some of these things. I think that's true of a lot of people, that we don't really think about stuff until we're forced to confront it. And I think this was the first time that she was really forced to confront it. And then it also doesn't help that T'Kene comes out with blood in his hands, which is a thing that is the recurring theme of anybody who was involved in the occupation. No matter who you were, no matter what you did, no matter what level of involvement you were on the thing, everybody came out of it a little bloody, you know? So Kira's having to reconcile that as well. That scene that you're talking about where she says, I don't know if I'm qualified. I don't know if I would ask the right questions. Again, I get what you're saying about when she said, when you're like, she's an officer. She's been in this role. She should know, you know, how to question somebody, how to interrogate someone, how to get these questions. But she's not just questioning a soldier who's gone AWOL. She's questioning this person that has a very personal connection to her. So will she be able to maintain a professionalism and get the questions? Will she allow her personal feelings to override her and not push when she needs to push? Will she push too far and hurt this person who means so much to her? Again, a lot of different levels of what could be driving her to be so suddenly unsure of herself, which is different from the Kira that we have come to experience up to this point. So again, I get what you're saying, but to me, I'm like, I'm seeing both, and I'm enjoying the internal conflict of Kira and watching her grow this way that we haven't seen before.
Well, I guess, so for example, the scene where she's talking with Sisko, that's like right before, I think, the like second commercial break. So a little early on the episode. I just feel like talking to Sisko about that was not the right person. That's a Dax moment. That's a Odo moment. And Odo does have a scene with her later in the episode, so don't get me wrong. But I feel like talking to her senior officer, the man who has every reason to be like, yeah, I need you to move forward on this. Like, you can go have your personal moment somewhere else. Like, again, Sisko's not the type to do that. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that. But for me, I guess what I'm getting at is, like, Kira has been someone who has struggled to overcome her just straight up hatred for Cardassians because of what they did.
Yes.
And the episode where she was taken to Cardassia and met him, what's his name again?
Second Skin is the episode, and T'Kene Gamor.
T'Kene Gamor. That episode was, I'll just summarize it this way. I know that a lot of time supposedly happens in that episode, but I don't, and to be fair, apparently these two have kept in contact since then.
Yes.
But for me, it felt like when she had him come to the station and she's all like, oh, it's so good to see you. I wish part of me wishes she had, there was just still that part of her that was reserved. Like there was this core.
Yes. I will agree with you there. I know what you're talking about. Yes, I will agree. As much as I think they could have dialed it back a little bit. I'm more than willing to buy into the fact that she has, in her brain, she's worked out a way to carve out a portion of love for this man.
Yes,
because of who because of who he was at the time to her.
Right. Yes.
But for her to be so overly glowing and fawning after spending a lifetime fighting Cardassians, bit much for us to go by. I don't care how nice he was. I don't care how much he was. You're like my daughter. You're as close as I'm ever going to get to my daughter again. I don't care.
Right.
The fact is, I could see her, instead of greeting him that way, she could still be like, you know, it is good to see you. I am glad you're here. That kind of thing. A little bit more reserved. Pulled back.
More
slightly.
Reserved.
Yes.
More anxious because she's like, can I trust this guy really? I mean, am I and really also, just going to trust a Cardassian? I mean, even Gul Dukat, I even gave him a second chance and I want to kill him.
But also, you know, for her friends that are there on the station, because, I mean, well, she went through this whole ordeal in Second Skin, sure, but a lot of them weren't there. And even like Worf,
the whole time,
And Worf, to me, was what everyone should have been. When Worf saw her being friendly towards a Cardassian, he was flabbergasted.
Yeah. And he was just she's a friend with a Cardassian? Yeah.
And he said, that's what he says. Kira's friends with a Cardassian. He says, it just seems wrong somehow. Like, and he's absolutely right. It should seem wrong. And it should seem wrong to others. Even, you know, probably the only person who would get a pass would be Jadzia, because she's always been Miss she's worldly, she's very accepting. So for her to be like, get over it, I could get it. But
right.
Kira is now, you know, going to be walking on the station, on the promenade, right. arm in arm with this Cardassian. Anyone right. else who's worked with her in the past 5 years, they wouldn't know what to make of that scene, of seeing her right. on the promenade, locked arms with this older Cardassian man.
Yes.
Yeah, where was that scene where they're walking along and she's, you know, showing him the sights, giving him a tour, whatever.
Yeah.
And somebody uh-huh. comes up and, you know, spits at her and calls her a collaborator or a traitor or something, you know. Right. Something along those lines to kind of throw in the fate. Or maybe she's wanting to give him a tour, but she holds back from giving him a tour. Find right. someone else to give him a tour. Because right. as much as she wants to, she's aware of the perception. And so she's kind of showing us how she has to get over certain things with him. Kind of like what right. we saw in the episode Duet in the third season, where it was with Aemon Maritza. And at the end, when it's revealed that Maritza was an imposter, and she was walking him through... Oh, season one. I'm sorry. It's not the
no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You're talking about season one, that character? I don't remember which character you're talking about.
So he's the one who was the older Cardassian who came on the station and claimed to be someone else, the filing clerk.
Yes.
And then
he was
Goldar Heel, and he was revealed to be Goldar Heel. Yeah.
Right.
And so then when they find out that he really is the filing clerk who had himself genetically altered, you know,
right.
She's walking him through the promenade to send him home, and another Bajoran comes up and stabs him and kills him right. on the promenade.
Oh,
and she's like, why? Why did you kill him? And he's like, he was a Cardassian. That's reason enough.
Right.
And Kira was like,
true.
No, it's not. So, yeah.
So that's a perfect example, I would say, of Kira has had growth in this area, and yet the show, I feel like, artificially brought her back. Let me put it this way. When Gul Dukat shows up in her quarters and says, I have some information about him you should know about, she should have slapped him across the face, grabbed the thing, and smashed it across her knee and said, I don't trust you. I know what you're doing. I don't care what you have to say. You're gone. Get out of here. You have lost my trust for one too many times. I don't care about him. Or, at the very least, if she had kept the thing and read it, I wish her moment when she's talking with Odo, where she's all like huffing and puffing, like I had to go have a private moment. I wish instead of her being like, I can't believe he did all those terrible things. Because later, we later find out that he was a low-level person. He didn't have authority to make decisions. He was just a grunt, basically. Mm-hmm. I wish she was struggling in that moment to, like, instead of – I wish she was fighting to realize her love for him in a real way. Like, I'm seeing this information about him that he hasn't told me, but I know who he is, and there must be something wrong here, but I don't want to confront him because I'm angry and I don't want to hear his excuses. Like, I wish he had more of a nuanced response is what I'm getting
at. Well, this is one of those that probably, you know, I know that despite what you're saying about the episode, probably could have benefited from being a two-parter, as many episodes in this show.
every episode should be a full-length almost, movie by now.
Almost,
come on,
hey,
now.
You know, almost at this point, because they present us with so much, and there's not enough time to resolve everything and cover everything in the detail that's needed. Right. So, yeah, there's always going to be something that is shortchanged. That's why, you know, that's one thing we definitely have to remember, and something that we have to, keep in your head so that you can kind of play things out a little bit and give them a little bit of credit for at least presenting some of this for us.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if they just tried to keep it to this narrow thing that they definitely know they can finish from beginning to end, we'd probably get some very flat, one-dimensional stories and... No one wants that. No one wants that.
I do want to say before we keep going, there is something that happened in this episode that I find it was like redeeming of the episode. I don't want to say it just yet because we'll get there. But there is something I want to say when we kind of get toward the end. The other thing I had a problem with is I didn't like the characterization of her father on his, you know, as he's dying, having been shot. he comes off as pretty pathetic, frankly. Maybe that who's the character is, but
I'm going to defend that, but only because the point of that was we are looking at this through Kira's memory. So she viewed him as weak. She was viewing him this way because of the way that he was dying. We don't know if that's the legitimate characterization of the man versus this is a person who is being deeply traumatized and affected by watching him die in real time. So I think that that is...
Well, I'll just push back on that and say that there was nothing that indicated that this was a potentially colored or misremembered memory of his death. Whenever we've had flashbacks, if it is something that we need to question how accurate it is, it would have been indicated.
Yeah.
So my only point is that, very clear, the point of those scenes is that she feels like her father and
Kenny Gamor.
Kenny Gamor are men that are similar. They're both men of peace. They weren't violent people. She sees them as similar men in her mind. And so this characterization of her father kind of makes sense in that way. When he was crying out, "Don't leave me," I just wanted the character to have a little bit more spine in him in that moment. Maybe it's not fair to always expect that a character would be like that. Maybe it's more realistic to say that, yeah, some people when they die in a way that isn't necessarily something you want to remember. Remember.
Not everyone gets a dignified end.
Yeah. I'll fully admit that. But it just, in top of everything else that was happening, I was like, oh man, this episode is not doing it for me. Okay.
That's perfectly fair.
Yeah.
This is one of the few that I liked the uncomfortableness. I liked the fact that it, you know, kind of rubs you wrong because you do have a certain feeling of this is how it's supposed to go. And so the fact that it didn't, I feel like it rubs you the wrong way just right, if that's a way of thinking here. Because it's like, yeah, you were wishing for more of this, or if only this person had been a bit more appropriate doing that other thing or whatever it was. The fact that you didn't get that, it's something to kind of hang on to and realize that, you know, those responses are not necessarily the only ones or the normal ones or whatever. People are going to react certain things differently. To your point about Dukat, when he came into her quarters and was like, yeah, I've got this information or whatever, you know, I did not enjoy that scene because I too didn't like the fact that after she gets all in his face and huffs and puffs and whatever, she still takes the thing and she reads it. And it's just, I guess it's to the credit of Dukat that even at his most nefarious, he is still persuasive enough that he can plant that seed of doubt and get you to ultimately do what he wants. That was really all he wanted. He didn't care, you know, that she believed him. He just wanted her to read it.
Right.
And that's what he got.
And have the seed of doubt planted.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I do feel like Kira is being consistent in her characterization throughout the show in the way she responded and then looking at it. My point is only that I feel like her character growth should have pushed her a little bit beyond what this episode ended up being.
Okay.
So, hey, whatever. But I do want to say, I'll get to my point. The redeeming scene in this episode that really, I got to the end and I was like, fantastic. Nana Visitor as Kira Nerys weeping about the death of Kenny Gamor and talking to Bashir how it reminded of her the death of her father. Honestly, I could have skipped all of the scenes of the flashbacks of her father. Didn't need to see any of that. All I needed to know is that she wasn't there for her father's death, that he was crying out for her, but she had left him, and she was an hour late to seeing him, and she missed his death by an hour, and so she was there for Kenny Gamor's death. He had an hour left, and she got there in time. I want characters to regret their choices and express that through weeping and tears at times, and have some catharsis, express that regret, And so when a character does that, gold. So, I mean, at the very end, didn't like the episode overall, but there is a giant gold nugget right there at the end. It's like, well, damn. All right. Okay.
And this is,
you did good.
this is where David and I differ, of course, because he likes to see them brought low and then have a redeeming factor. Me, I see them brought low and then I go, can you go lower? Are we sure we're scraping the bottom here?
Yeah. Rock bottom ain't got nothing on Barry's mind. Yeah.
Screw rock bottom. Blow that rock out of there. Keep going. Go down. I like seeing them just get to that absolute and just realizing there is nothing left and there is nothing they can do about it. I would have been perfectly satisfied had she had the realization and rushed to Kenny's side, only to find out he had died. Just a few moments before she got there, he had died. And just like her father, he died calling her name. And Bashir is standing at the bedside, and she walks in the door, and she whips. He whips his head around, and he's like, "Where were you? All he wanted was you by his bedside, and you couldn't even have the decency, the courage, the whatever, to stand here." I would have loved to see him just...
Don't get on Perry's bad side, man.
Not at, I'm telling you, hey, telling you. I would have loved to see that and then have her, like, storming out and the tears and the realization.
Man, you and I need to write something. Man, you and I going back and forth on a plot like that, figuring out where the best plot lines go. And I just want to quickly say, one of the reasons I like that Red Rising book series is he was willing to go. Like, you would hit rock bottom, and then you'd be like, oh, crap, there's a deeper bottom.
That's what I like right there. It's like, just when you think it couldn't get any lower, you're like, okay. Because we read so many things, we watch so many things, you kind of pick up on the beats. So when you see that it's already on that downhill slope, you are already, even though it's still going negative, you're already anticipating that bounce back. You're anticipating the next part is going to be the redemption arc. I don't want that. I want you to miss that beat. I want you to find another bit of darkness and despair and melancholy to wallow in for a little bit longer than you feel like you should. Like, that's what I feel like the story really sticks with you, is because it went a little bit further than you think that it should, and you're realizing, okay, like, because that's life. Like, nothing occurs in life on a consistent timetable. You know, you have your peaks and valleys, sure, but they never come when you think that they should, and certainly not when you really want them to. So I hate that, you know, all of our television, whether it's comedy, drama, whatever, they all follow these particular beats, these patterns, and if you watch enough of them, you can pick up on them, and it ruins a lot of the storytelling to me. So I like finding things that break that up and mess that up.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, I just, I would be interested in reading those books. And again, that scene to me, like, even in my head playing it, I was like, that would have been such a powerful scene. Like, that was the lesson that she learned. And then later on.
That'd be so dark, though.
Yeah, I know. That's what I want. Make it dark. Make it dark. And
break
then,
the
like,
characters over the knee of tragedy.
And then let me see that lesson learned, that callback in like the final season. Somebody else who is dying or whatever, and just when you think they're gonna die alone, Kira is there. The unexpected Kira. Like, their relationship wasn't necessarily, like, it was consistent, it was strong, but it wasn't the one that maybe you thought of 100% of the time. But then in this moment of their ending, they turn around and they know they're going to die, whatever, but the camera pans around and the person who's there is Kira. And they're just like, they're shocked and they're like, why are you here? And she just says, because no one deserves to die alone. Great, excellent callback. I would have loved to see that. I just that everything right there in one sentence in season 7, season 8, wherever we are when it happens, one sentence tying together like 5 seasons of growth and development of a character. One sentence. I would have loved it. Loved it.
Yeah. There's still a chance, I guess.
I'm sorry. Mild spoiler. We don't get to see that. But yeah.
Oh, well.
That would have... To me, that's the kind of thing that I look for when there's those kind of callbacks.
Fan fiction episode. There you go. The other fun thing on this episode, of course, was Wei-Yun. We should probably talk about him real fast.
Wei-Yun 5, because we saw Wei-Yun 4 die. A Metachron snapped his neck.
Did we know he was
4
before? He was just Wei-Yun in the previous episode. There was no Wei-Yun 4.
That's
it
true.
It was just Wei-Yun. But now
we did not,
now
we did not know about, yes, we did not know about the cloning process. But yeah, Sisko, is it Sisko? He's like, I saw you die. He was like, oh, yeah. You mean Wei-Yun 4. I'm Wei-Yun 5. And then he tells him about the cloning and so forth. So the Vorta are clones.
Yeah.
Interesting way to have a population, I guess.
or to keep your actors nearby at hand. Hey, you did a great job last time. Come back.
Right. Yeah, I could just see that conversation. Hey, Jeffrey Combs, you want to come back? We need Wei-Yun. didn't he die like 2 seasons ago? Don't worry about it. We'll figure it out. We like you. Come on back.
Yeah.
Come on back.
What's funny about him in this episode is he's much more snarky than he was in the previous one. I mean, he was snarky in the previous one, but he was having to, like, you know, be the Jim Hadar wrangler. This one, he's just, like, following Gul Dukat around, being his little sidekick, kind of. And it was fun because he's basically, like, pressing buttons on for Sisko. And we got to say it. Sisko in this episode was great. That moment where Gul Dukat's like, we want him extradited back to Cardassia. And he's like, well, the Federation doesn't recognize your government, and we don't have any extradition treaties, so don't get your hopes up. Click.
Click. Yes. Yes. The 24th century hang-up. He did it great. And with a smile on his face. I wouldn't get your hopes up. Bam. Yeah. Done. Loved it.
Yeah,
and becomes... his whole treatment of Dukat in that scene, because Dukat is just going on and on. He's like, "I'm very busy. What do you want?" Like he's through putting up with him, and I love it. He has not given him a single bit of quarter here, and he's like, "You are talking to the head of the government." He's like, "I don't care." Like just. I love the irreverency that he's treated with, that he treats him with, and you know the way that he constantly challenges Dukat and Wei-Yun is, he almost reminds you of like a child to a bit because nothing bothers him. He's perfectly pleasant and cheerful, and even when he's standing there watching Dukat and Sisko kind of bristle against each other, he's so delighted. He's like, ooh, look at all the at all the shiny.
Ooh, this is a poison chalice. You drink it. Yeah. Just, it tingles as it goes down or whatever he said.
Yeah, I mean he's just wonderfully irreverent and Jeffrey Combs is great. He's a great actor. Obviously Star Trek loves him, as evidenced by the many characters he's played in his tenure with Trek, something that continues to just be hilarious. At this point, I feel like at certain points, they are just writing characters to figure out a way to put Jeffrey Combs in the row. He's already showed up on Lower Decks. I would not be surprised at all if he showed up on Strange New Worlds. In fact, I think that they should do it just because it's almost Star Trek tradition at this point that he'd be on the show in some capacity. So, they need to go ahead and, you know, next season, I want to see Jeffrey Combs on Strange New Worlds because he's such a great actor. It's not just that he's fun and that his characters are engaging, but he's just such a great actor and he does so well. And I have yet to see a crew that he hasn't been able to act with and work with. Bring on more of that. And we're not done with him at all in his myriad roles on Deep Space Nine. So we will see more of Mr. Combs in his abilities here.
Gotcha.
So before we, you know, get to the end, I feel like we gotta spend a little bit more time on Gul Dukat because the way in which they're presenting him as this, you know, he's intimating that he's got some machinations here. And we're seeing him as his power is on the rise. You know, he's feeling very comfortable with the Dominion backing him. And he's the head of the Cardassian government and the Cardassian military. And he's so important, and yet he can hop on the next ship out and be at Deep Space Nine like that, you know, and he's gone from being on a screen to now he's face to face. And right. How does he make it to Kira's quarters? You know, I didn't see a security guard. Do you? You know? Yeah. And he's just walking around. It's like, no one sees this man. No one's going to try and stab him. You know? Like, come on.
Yeah. Well, and the funny... Oh, sorry. Keep going. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's all. I'm just...
Honestly, the funny thing, too, was after Sisko hung up on him, he shows up not in a Cardassian ship, but in a Dominion ship. And we know the Dominion have technology that the Federation can't stop. You know, when they first showed up in Season 2, they were able to beam onto the station and get through the security field no problem. Mm-hmm. So when Gul Dukat shows up using the Dominion to back him up, it's a great moment because Sisko is he's forced to let him on. We can tell he lets them on, but he doesn't give up to Gamor.
No.
But the whole time, I mean, it's never explicitly said, or at least it's kind of hinted at, but Gul Dukat only exists in his role at the pleasure of the Dominion.
Yes.
Like, you have to wonder if Gul Dukat's either stupid, which he's not, or trying to play some sort of long angle. Like, how committed
I'm
is he
go,
really to this alliance?
I'm going to go with that. No, because if there's one trait that we can definitely assign to Dukat, it's that this is a man who does whatever it takes to serve his own ends, his own needs. He's right. Very, very self-important. And right. Anything that he can do to maintain his own sense of worth and power, he's right. Going to do to the detriment of everyone around him. He doesn't care about anything else, as long as he appears to be a powerful man, a powerful right. person, he's going to do it. And right. that's what the Dominion is giving him right now. He thinks that he is ultimately going to prove to be the smarter of the two, him right. versus the entire Dominion, and right. he's going to somehow come out on top of even the Dominion. And right. no one is going to be able to, you know, stop him, top him, whatever. That's right. how he's positioning himself. And he's quite sure, quite arrogant. He is the embodiment of all the characteristics we've come to learn about Cardassians as their fatal flaw. He's overconfident. He's incredibly arrogant. He is definitely egomaniacal. And he, you know, the self-importance, again, is just through the roof. So, yeah, all of these things are right. the classic things that have always led to the Cardassian downfall. And we're seeing them
right.
totally personified in this individual.
Right. Yeah. As you were talking, I realized there was something I was thinking about earlier, but I forgot to mention. And this would play in perfectly. If Gamor had come on the station and had some sort of assistant Cardassian with him, someone who was more in that kind of gray area, someone who, like, do we trust this guy who's the assistant to Gamor? It could be, he could have been the foil to Kira's, you know, Kira's kind of all fawning all over him. But then, you know, there's this Cardassian who, like, actually has a reason to be allied with him. Like, they've known each other. He's been his assistant for a long time or something. But I was actually, if we switch that up, if we bring Gul Dukat's daughter in, because she has a relationship with Kira, if Kira had been like, oh yeah, I'm friends now with Gul Dukat's daughter, whose name I forget at the moment.
Zial.
And like, she introduced him to her, and Zial and Gamor get to know each other, but like, we could get them like the more family dynamic going or something. Man. I'm trying to find ways to make things
work.
Yeah,
I can see that too. Like, he meets Zial and hearing her story, they really start to bond over this being in exile.
And she could be the one who was sitting by the bedside when Kira failed to show up, to go with your version of the plot at the end. She could have been the one who, like, looked at Kira with, like, what's up? Like, you introduced me to him.
With disappointment. Like, she wouldn't look at Kira with hatred, but she...
No, disappointment. Exactly.
Disappointment.
100%.
Because Kira was the one who was showing such acceptance of Zial as well. And so it's just like, yeah, having Zial see Kira as this person who potentially really doesn't like Cardassians, hasn't forgiven them, and her being part Cardassian and really, you know, more Cardassian presenting than anything else, I could see that causing some issues for Zial. So yeah, there's another level of complexity there that we could have added to Kira learning a lesson for this episode.
I'm telling you, man, you and I need to get together. We need to do something already.
got the ideas, man. That's all it takes. You just got to sit and like just start talking about it.
Yeah.
And like, I really want to see stuff like this and coming up with characters. I could do this all day. Like, seriously.
Oh,
this
I know.
Is,
this is so my favorite. Too.
Yeah. Again, David and I have known each other for quite a while. We used to do this when we worked together.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, I love, like, even with Dune today, I was reading the book and I was like, I even got up my little notebook and I was like, I would have done this. Like, wrote down a little note. Like, I would have done it this way. But, so. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you heard it here first, folks. So, you know, in the next, like, year or two, if a book comes out and it's got some kind of written by and it's an amalgamation of our names, buy it, read it, and tell us, okay, Perry definitely wrote this part because it's like nothing but despair. And then David wrote this part where they were uplifted. So there you go. But you heard it here first.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Well, final thoughts on Ties of Blood and Water.
Yeah. Well, I'll just summarize it this way. I want characters to have emotional storylines. And so Kira having that moment at the end of the episode was great. We haven't even mentioned that Avery Brooks directed this episode.
Get to that.
Yeah.
Before we end that, that's a great point. We can bring that up real quick. Just to say that the actor who played T'Kenny Gamore, he really appreciated working with Avery Brooks and his direction and his direction skill. He talks about how Avery Brooks really challenged him, pushed him to engage his character in different ways, which really seemed to bring out the story and kind of enhance what they were getting here. And again, the actor's name is Lawrence Pressman. He does a great job as T'Kenny, both in Second Skin and here. Yes, he was a little bit heavy-handed on the whole "you're like a daughter to me" so forth. But
that
once
was
we
the
get,
writing.
Yeah, that was yeah. And once we get past that, the scenes with him are quite touching, I think. Yeah. So and he gives a lot of credit for that to Avery Brooks, which once again just kind of proves that Avery Brooks is not just a phenomenal, you know, actor, but he's obviously an incredible director. And a lot of the episodes that he's directed have always been very impactful, very moving. And I like that we see that. And that another actor appreciates that as well. So, but go ahead.
Yeah. So just summarize, Nana Visitor, let me put it this way. Crying is the hardest thing to do on screen. She had red eyes. Like, I think Nana Visitor was able to get there in the role, in the moment, in the scene. Fantastic. So even though I didn't love this episode and definitely have some critiques about how it went and have suggestions for how it might be fixed, I won't deny that that last scene was phenomenal and definitely a cherry on top for the episode. So,
And real quick before we end everything, it is also worth noting that Lawrence Pressman, this is not the first time that we saw him on Deep Space Nine. While T'Kenny Gamore is the first person that we see him as, he also plays Ambassador Krajewski, who actually turns out to be a changeling. He's the changeling that Odo kills. Changeling that Odo kills, which is why Odo eventually has to go back and gets turned into a humanoid and all that kind of stuff. Krajewski is the Pressman is the actor who played Krajewski, who was the changeling. So there you go.
Gotcha.
So yeah, Deep Space Nine likes recycling actors, which, I mean, hey, why not? You're going to put some makeup on them. You're not going to recognize them. And I mean, if it wasn't for the internet and everything being documented, a lot of this stuff wouldn't be, you know, known right now without some hardcore deep dive. So there you go.
Yeah. Thank you, internet.
Yeah. Well, guys, I think that's going to do it for us here on this episode of The Fire Caves. As always, you can watch us live on YouTube, which some of you probably did tonight, even though this was a different night from our regular Saturday night broadcast. clearly we had things to do this weekend, so we couldn't do our show at a normal time. Also, again, I am aware we are still slightly behind on the releasing of the podcast for the various streaming platforms. The last episode that is available currently would be the First Contact special. So we've got two episodes off. Going to release those or make sure they get released this week. I'm not sure what's exactly gumming up the works here, so I'm just going to like take them down and then redo them. Hopefully that takes care of all that. But because I'm doing it that way, that means that this week you'll technically get two, maybe three episodes. I'm not sure how far back the issue goes. So I'm just going to check that out and try and clear it and then reload them. So hopefully that takes care of the issue. So it may be that this Saturday you get three episodes, so 3 hours of us that you get to sift through and enjoy. So hopefully you love that. Other than that, you can, again, find us and follow us anywhere that you happen to do your social medias. And, of course, you can listen to us on any platform that you get your podcast from. I happen to do it on Spotify. So until next week, guys, take care of yourselves.
Thanks, guys.